It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host on WGN Radio. Thank you for joining me. Going to start off with a quick trip I made this week to something, though, that's very environmentally significant, and that was down to Florida. Who goes to Florida in June? All the migratory birds have left, and most of the people have left. So it's actually a delightful time to go, particularly if what you're trying to accomplish is work in the Everglades to understand the water quality that leaving the agricultural community and headed into the Everglades. And I learned something very, very surprising. I've talked for quite a bit about how the Everglades is a misunderstood ecosystem, and there'll be more on that coming. There's going to be a release of an IMAX movie in about a year talking about the Everglades. But one of the profound misconceptions is that the Everglades was in great shape before we began to grow a lot of agricultural production south of Lake Okeechobee. That is just not true. Over the last 60 years, agriculture has expanded enormously into the Everglades region and in water basin. But the clarity of the water now leaving the agricultural areas of south of Lake Okeechobee in Florida and flowing into the Everglades is better than the quality of water coming into Lake Okeechobee north from all of the human settlement that has taken place from northern Florida down through Orlando to Lake Okeechobee. So the reason to bring this up today is there is a lot of discussion as to how the Everglades are going to be sustained with clean water. What I found on my trip is that the Everglades is now being sustained with vastly cleaner water than had ever been the case since the settlement, really after World War II, of Florida. And that the quality of water entering the Everglades is far better than that in Lake Okeechobee, which in and of itself is supposed to be a purifier of aquifers and water. But because it's so overloaded with nitrogen and phosphorus from areas north of Florida, largely due to human runoff waste from septic fields and non-functioning or poorly functioning septic and waste treatment plants, that agriculture, which has been vilified as the reason the Everglades has bad water quality, actually today is a part of the reason the Everglades has vastly improved water quality because of what agriculture has done to clean up the water coming through agriculture, the leveling of fields, the retention ponds, the reduce of the use of chemicals. All kinds of things are being done by the largest produce producers in America, some of them, the largest sugar producers in America, to make sure that their environment, water quality-wise, in fact, sustains the Everglades, because they know that without a sustainable Everglades, they're out of business as well. So as we move further into what is going to be a national dialogue, and you've probably read or heard in the past 6 months about not the hundreds of millions, but the billions of dollars that is being spent on water retention and cleaning up the Everglades, almost all of that is taking place south of the Everglades, Lake Okeechobee. And the real need is, in many cases, north of Lake Okeechobee. So like any conservation issue, it's a complicated problem, but I wanted to mention briefly that I was in Florida briefly looking at this, and I do think there is a solution to this, and much of the Everglades is already being saved, and it's being saved because of the cooperation and collaboration of agricultural interests, the state, and conservation interests. So the news is not at all doom and gloom. A lot of work has been done, and there's more work to be done. But in my view, from what I saw, the tide has definitely turned, and in many cases, much of the water quality entering the Everglades is better than it's been in the past 80 years. Also in Florida this time of the year, well, you have to fish. You can't go and not fish. The snook are running on the West Coast. right on the beaches off of Boca Grande and the famed pass, the Tarpon Pass. People are standing in the surf, actually not even the surf because the water is calm, fly fishing or spin casting and catching snook for a 100-mile stretch along the west coast of Florida. After most people have left and the boat traffic has quieted down, the snook move back into closer proximity to land, and also they're migrating. But one of the things that definitely people are aware of as Florida surges in population during the winter is that the amount of boat traffic has a significant impact on how fish migrate and behave. And all the disturbance of boats, pleasure boats, that's taking place now in South Florida, East Coast and West Coast, has had a definitive impact on the quality of the fishing, the murkiness of the water, and also some think the migratory paths of fish. But when 90% of the boat traffic clears out, as it has since the beginning of May, and everything settles down, the fish settle down too. And fishing in Florida in the summer, of course, we all go north. We go north to Lake of the Woods. We go to Canada. We go west. We go to trout streams. We go to Lake Michigan. We go to ponds in Illinois. We go to forest preserves. The furthest thing we're thinking of is about fishing in Florida. Summer fishing in Florida is incredible. The combination of that and purifying the water going into the Everglades paints a very promising picture for the future of South Florida. Not the development future of South Florida. It seems like it's going to be never ending. But from a conservation point of view, despite the huge numbers of people that have moved to South Florida, Florida in general, and that are visiting Florida, we do seem to finally be making progress on understanding how these ecosystems can survive, not only survive, but really be sustained in a high-quality way. And whether it's Florida Bay, whether it's the Everglades, whether it's the whole ecosystem of South Florida, there now appear to be ways to improve the water quality that are being demonstrated, to also protect really key breeding areas, whether it be for manatees or the mangroves that are so needed by so many bait fish. We're a long way from Florida and Illinois, particularly in the summer. People aren't thinking about it. But it's a story that's unfolding that's certainly a success for conservation. Moving from Florida, before I take the break on the Great Outdoor Show in the summer, one of the things that I love to talk about, and I'll talk about when we come back on the show, are some interesting factoids about how birds migrate and what we learn about birds. And not everything migrates in the air. Very interesting how fish and mammals migrate as well. But before I leave this for the break, I want to say that a new Department of Interior rule is expanding hunting and fishing access on federal lands. And this rule, which is order number 3447, to be bureaucratic, issued by the Secretary of Interior, Doug Burgum, is a directive that will expand hunting and fishing opportunities on federal lands. Under the new rule, and this has been decades in the making but not happened until now, the open unless closed rule is a standard that treats all Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Bureau of Reclamation Lands as open to hunting and fishing unless a specific, documented, and legally supported exception applies. This is an enormous change from the years of pressure that we've had to close federal lands to hunting and fishing. Instead, the Department of Interior is saying, no, these are our public lands in America. They're supposed to be open to the public to use. These are our lands for hunting and fishing. And only if there is a scientifically specific documented legal reason to support not hunting and fishing on federal lands, they're going to be open to hunting and fishing. That is a huge change in conservation policy. I'll be back in just a minute with much more on the Great Outdoors. This is Charlie Potter, the outdoor voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go, worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. This is Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you for joining me. I hope you're enjoying the show. The headline is Silent Killer. That's a terrible headline. It's about retrievers. Dogs are a man's best friend, or let's just call it a human's best friend. And new research is offering hope in identifying and treating cancer in canines. It appears that certain species of dogs are much more susceptible to cancer than others, and that not only are certain species of dogs more susceptible, but that hunting dogs within that community of Labradors and Golden Retrievers and Chesapeake Bay Retrievers, that Golden Retrievers are perhaps more susceptible to getting cancer than Labradors or Chesapeake Bay Retrievers. However, there is a commonality between them. So research recently from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine indicates that there are a number of red flags for an increased risk of lymphoma in dogs. And that risk is the highest among Golden Retrievers, but it really applies to the full circle. Broadleaf weed killers appear to be strongly associated with canine bladder cancer. Leading the University of Wisconsin and Dr. Lauren Trepaner to offer that you should not use any kind of broadleaf herbicide on your lawns. And she said that you should not walk your dog in areas that have been recently treated with weed killers. It gets on their feet, on their paws, and they lick their paws and goes into their system. We don't do that as humans. We don't walk on a lawn with our bare feet and then go lick our feet. But dogs do that, and it goes directly into their system. And so she says there is a strong association with bladder cancer and canine and broadleaf herbicides. And since about 10 or 15 years ago, the University of UC Davis Veterinary School in California has been studying the long-term health effects of neutering on dogs. And it has led them to the belief, and this is really sad, that spaying a female golden retriever at any age increases her risk for developing cancer by a factor of 3 to 4. So 3 to 4 times more likely that a golden retriever female will get cancer if it's been neutered. And also, it appears the cancer rates for Labradors that have been neutered are higher. So not every case of cancer can be prevented, but it's clear now with some of the information we have that the increase in cancer rates among dogs, or they call it the silent killer, is exposure to broadleaf pesticides on your lawn and neutering of dogs. So obviously these are not hard fast, but this is based upon data that they have been finding. And cumulatively, the University of Florida's Veterinary Medicine School is involved as well, the University of Minnesota's College of Veterinary Medicine. They're all coming to the same conclusion. And in Dr. Jamie Medano of the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine said, this is probably the most significant finding that we've had in the last 30 years in linking canine cancer to certain causes. So we love our dogs. All of you have Goldens, you really love them. Unfortunately, it looks like spaying or neutering your dog is not a good thing to do. Let's move to something really interesting and happy at the end of the show, and that is some factoids about birds. One of the factoids is that birds, as we know, are capable of remarkably long journeys. A blue-winged teal banded in Canada can be recovered as far south as Peru. That's 6,000 miles away. The longest flying champion, however, is a northern pintail. This is what we know. That was banded in Niigata, Japan, and was recovered near Ruleville, Mississippi, 6,500 miles away. Think about that. A duck flew 6,500 miles on its migration route, and they don't fly in straight lines. One of the things that's also happened is that technology's evolved, and I talked about this last week. In 1965, a scientist from the from the Illinois Natural History Survey, in 1965, flew a Piper Cub 400 miles using electronic radio signals after tagging a tiny radio transmitter on a thrush. Think of the size of a thrush. It's not even the size of your hand. And that was really the beginning of breakthrough in a lot of ways of being able to monitor birds in flight. How about water routes? Not all birds migrate by flying. And penguins are considered birds. How about they migrate 4,000 miles by open ocean swimming? Birds can go 4,000 miles in the air. Try being a penguin and going 4,000 miles in the ocean from Chile all the way around to Rio de Janeiro. Think about that. Also, when birds are in flight, and I'll end the show with this because we all talk to each other. When birds are at flight, particularly through the night, they adapt a very specific kind of vocalization. And it's called by scientists nocturnal flight calls, one of the few non-scientific names scientists use. The calls are subtle and short, and they may not last more than half a second. But these chirps and tweets are believed to help individual birds keep track of their migratory companions while flying in the dark. So there are about 3,600 different calls that have been recorded outside of Madison, Wisconsin, of migrating birds. And today, we use highly calibrated acoustics and recorders and specialized software to monitor migratory flights. But birds, we know whales communicate when they're swimming. Birds communicate as well. Thanks so much for listening. Next Sunday morning, I'll be back, and it will be Father's Day. And for all of you fathers, I hope I have a great show for you. Thanks for listening. Have a great week in the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.